Good afternoon. This is Dr. John Pinero, and you're tuned into Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. I'm very thrilled to have our guest on the program today. I've lived in Grand Rapids for 11 years, and many of my associates and friends and colleagues and Catholic friends especially are quite taken with the work of our guest, and I've read it as well, and I think you're in for a very interesting trip through Catholic teaching and what it is and what it isn't, and one of the great debates we are having inside the church today, but debates that I think are important for those not in communion with the Catholic Church and for people around the world. And that has to do with this thing, and we'll define these terms later, things that like economics, capitalism, exchange among people, and how ought these things work, and what would an economy or a society look like organized along Catholic principles, and how do you get there, and did such a thing ever exist? Helping us out today, then, is going to be John Madai, author of Towards a Truly Free Market, a Distributist Perspective on the Role of Government, Taxes, Healthcare, Deficits, and More. What a great title. And also author of The Vocation of Business, which he uses in a class he teaches at the University of Dallas. John, welcome to the program Faith and Reason.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You say a number of things in your book, Towards a Truly Free Market, that I'd like to talk about on the program and see if we can't, for our listeners more than anything, talk about this thing invariably called distributivism, distributism, and whether it is a thing at all in terms of something like socialism or capitalism. It ends in an ism. And I've noted in recent years that there's really an uptick in talk about distributism, and not just among readers and devotees of G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, but really thanks to you and a few others, I think, people who have kind of updated and done much more work than Chesterton or Belloc ever did in terms of distributism. You say in the book, to quote you, you say, distributism is nothing more than the rediscovery of an older view of economics. And I thought maybe that would be a good place to start, this rediscovery of an older view of economics. So, you know, how old, and let's unpack that statement for a little bit, and then we'll go on, I think, maybe to talk about Pope Francis, who was many of his statements about economics have been quite controversial in the United States, even among Catholics.
Sure. I think that's a great place to begin. If you're asking about why it's the older view, well, it's capitalism is of rather recent vintage, going back no later than the 14th century, and not really predominating the world until the 18th or even 19th century. So we tend to see everything in terms of capitalism and socialism, but actually those are mirror images of each other. That was not the predominant view of how economics worked from Aristotle forward. As a matter of fact, it only comes about, it only achieves predominance, and it does recur at various places in history, say the late Greek Hellenistic world, the late Roman world. It only appears generally in ages of decadence.
Interesting. No, why so? When I think of the Roman world, I think of largely a plantation slavery world that had to subsist on, well, conquering other peoples, or that grew economically stagnant.
I think you're exactly right. And I think exactly those things are not unrelated. They're intimately related. As the Roman citizen in the Republic was generally a farmer. He was generally a landowner. He grew his own food. He was self-subsistent. And as such, he could also be a citizen. However, as Rome progressed, and especially in its wars, as it conquered, in a sense, its military might was its undoing. The soldiers went off for their 20-year enlistments, and they lost their farms because Their wives could, and their children simply could not work the farm sufficiently. They fell into debt. Their farms were lost to the upper class, to the aristocratic class. Why? That class could go off and make war and have slaves work the farm. So the Roman soldiers lost their land. They became a landless proletariat in Rome, a mob, and the wealth of the empires served to form a state of bread and circuses to keep the mob pacified. But it was not, in a sense, free citizens, because I think free citizens properly considered involve some notion of property. And without that property, they're just dependents of the state. So, and that's a history that's repeated over and over in the world. This movement to freedom, the sort of this predominance of capital. And we're just living out a cycle that we have seen before in world history.
Well, let's dwell on property for a minute. So when we talk about what's being distributed then with a term like distributism, then we're primarily talking then about property, as in real property, the kind of property on which you can grow something, to which you can retreat if need be and live out your life?
Exactly. We're talking about primarily productive property. Okay. Not primarily, but especially today, not only land. But land certainly is the primary property that is necessary for all other production.
Did such a society, I mean, would you argue that such a society did exist at one point in history, where we would have this pretty widespread private property ownership, or small freeholding farmers? There's many terms in different societies over the years, and I know we're concentrating mainly on Europe here, and we've talked already of Rome, but I think of the the Germanic barbarian invasions and the vast changes and Greek civilization before this. You did mention the Hellenistic period. Is there a time prior to the Christian dispensation where this is how man lived?
No, yes. I mean, it's like I say, it's the most natural system. It's always the primary system. And it takes a long time in the history of any society for this natural system to be displaced by a purely capitalistic system, by a system in which capital, which the ownership of vast tracts of property that you do not directly work, and which people are virtually slaves. It takes a long time for the older system to be undermined and to convert the free population of owners into a slave or semi-slave population. This is nothing new. It's a historical motif.
Okay, so are you arguing then for cycles in history, so we could kind of see this ebb and flow of freedom and slavery, for instance?
Sure. Yes. Oh. Yeah. In almost any civilization you look at, you will see that that cycle. I mean, it's the cycle. At the base of that cycle is greed.
Okay.
So it's a human constant, no matter where you go.
So our goal then in a society, I think, would be to we're trying to stave off human greed, right? I mean, we can't outlaw everything. We know that. And Thomas Aquinas says we shouldn't outlaw everything. But then we're trying to stave off greed. The distributist literature I've read, which includes you and Thomas Stork and Hilaire Belloc and some of Chesterton's writings, points to usually the high point of Christendom, that is, let's say, the 13th century in Europe, as a time when if this vision of society organized along these lines, not only because it's natural but in accord with a Christian understanding of justice, they argued, that would be – it's been kind of downhill since then. If we want to talk about a cycle, then we're coming out of this Roman system you describe, building up maybe up to 1,000 years later, and then this other decline, which you date, I guess, exactly to the kind of the birth of capitalism, as you describe it, right around the same time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
I think that's, yeah, that's the basic outline.
So what did that society look like? If you're going to describe, let's say we're talking Western Europe then. So we know it's a mainly agricultural society, but there's growing towns and villages and at least those merchant city-states that are really growing in a big way at the time in Italy, like Venice. What would my life have been like as one of those farmers? You know, pretty good, enough to eat, not enough to eat, but at least I know right from wrong, and I'm, you know, serious about my faith. What would life be like for me?
Actually, I mean, it depends on where you are and in what social condition you are in, because there are degrees here. But for the copyholder or the on an estate, life wouldn't have been that bad. The matter of fact, it would be pretty good. You would work far less than you do today. Have fairly reliable access to food, to all the necessities, and you would be, despite the fact that you might legally be a serf, you would actually be closer to a yeoman or a peasant because you had effective use of the land. They didn't have something economically that we have. They didn't have economic rent. Okay, if you rent a piece of property, as the value of the land improves, as you improve the land, the rent goes up to absorb more and more of what you produce. This is called economic rent. It's a fairly fixed law of modern economics. The peasant did not pay an economic rent. He paid a customary rent. Didn't change. And it was more related to the value of the services given to the land than the productivity of the land. So you performed a certain amount of labor for the Lord. You provided a certain amount of goods and a small amount of cash. But everything you over that you kept. It was yours. And so the more you improved your land, the harder you worked, the more you got to keep. Your rent wouldn't change. This led, well, around the 8th or 9th century to what's called the Second Agricultural Revolution, because these farmers, who were still legally serfs, which is the Latin word for slaves, got very, very creative. And so we had a whole bunch of agricultural innovations. You had the moldboard plow. You had the spiked harrow. You had the horse collar. You had the stirrup. You had the use of legumes, three-crop rotation, a whole host of inventions that made farming very, very profitable. And the peasant, very, very prosperous. So that would be your life economically. At the same time, you had a religious system that guaranteed lots of holidays, lots of vacations. I mean, the Middle Ages invent the vacation.
Oh, yeah, the feast day calendar was something else, sure.
Yes. You actually had more days off than a modern man has. You had a vacation, you went on pilgrimage to Walsingham or to Canterbury. You know, it's the Canterbury Tales. Uh-huh. We invented the vacation. We invented the tourist.
And so this is because, would you say this is because, I guess, knowing God, living the good life, this was higher than all else? I mean, this is the ultimate goal of people in Christian society?
I think it was even more than that. It was that, you see, we make divisions in our life. So we go to church on Sunday, we work the rest of the week, we watch football on Saturday, whatever it is. But we make these divisions in our life. It's just the mental attitude we have. They made fewer distinctions, fewer divisions. Things were more integral. I mean, so the model of the Benedictines, ora et labora, work and prayer, they really weren't ever totally distinct. it's a whole different mental attitude. So the peasant in his work stops for the Angelus. You see, it's just a it's probably incomprehensible to us, but it's nevertheless something we sort of have to acknowledge in their psychology and sort of lament its loss in ours. So I think we have to work to overcome these sharp distinctions that we make and sort of try to make the lines a little fuzzier than they are.
Did that division begin with the Protestant Reformation? Was the Reformation more of a symptom of an earlier division? What's your read on that?
My read is that the Reformation it's too easy to blame the Reformation. I don't think the Reformation caused the changes so much as accelerated them.
Okay.
If you look at, I think capitalism really begins as sort of a degenerate form of Catholicism in the northern Italian cities, which were preeminent in their day.
Okay,
that's
yeah.
Where all the economic power was in northern Italy and Venice and Florence and towns like that. And they began this predominance of capital over labor, which John Paul denounces in Laborum Exertium.
Could we, for a moment, let's get a good working definition of capitalism. I know at Aquinas College with my students, this is one of the things we spend time on. I use Wilfred McClay's book in my U.S. history class, which is published by ISI, just lists a bunch of terms that can be – you can mean so many different things by them. We want to make sure what we're talking about. So when you say capitalism, what do you mean by capitalism? When you say this is so capital over labor, you said. What do we mean here by capitalism?
Well, I think that's just it. That capitalism is named for its predominant form of property, which is capital.
Okay.
And it is precisely that predominance of capital – over all the other factors of production that make capitalism.
So it's by the person the one person has the capital, but I have to provide the labor because I don't have my own means of production, be those tools, be that land. Is that?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly what capitalism does. It divides work from the worker. It divides the work is actually owned by somebody else. We talk of the rich giving jobs, you know, and the worker is just then the cog in the machine that fulfills those jobs. The work does not arise from the worker in capitalism. It arises from the capitalist. That's not a natural state of affairs.
So what about those folks who, I don't know, I mean, we're all created differently by God, and I know people who seem, gosh, they're just, you know, they're much better at thinking in an entrepreneurial way than I am, or they're better at one thing, I'm better at another. And I wonder when I read about distributism and think about it, what about those who really, you know, somehow they're happier as a worker than as a freeholding farmer or somebody who has to, you know, rely on their own private property? Or what if their prosperous neighbor buys their land? Would distributism then say that's capitalism now, or and a bad thing? Let's say I'm really prosperous, I'm in my area, and I, you know, buy up other farms, and the people sell them to me, not because they're desperate, but because it seems like a good deal, right? The mutually beneficial exchange, like the classical economists will call it, right? Do you see that as a bad thing, or is there maybe there's something I'm missing about it? What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things there. It's quite true that there are different capabilities, different interests in different people, and a lot of people would not like to work a farm. I certainly wouldn't. I much prefer to read and teach and you know, pontificate about world affairs than, mm-hmm. than actually work them. So, sure, there's that.
Yeah. And full disclosure, I was raised as a farm kid.
Have great ability in these things and mm-hmm. Produce things. However, what is need to keep in mind is that every proper right is known by its limits. And that if you don't look at... we have a tendency to speak in terms of abstract rights, which divorces them from obligations, which divorces them from social context, and absolutizes them. And that's always the sign and signature of a great problem. Because if property is an unlimited right, then in theory, one person could own it all and everybody else could be their slave. And in practice, only a few actually own property, productive property, to any great degree, and everybody else becomes their slave or semi-slave, wage slave. So this right, this property is proper to man. So it is a right of man. But like all rights, it has its limits.
So... Okay, so the distributist then would, does the distributist then trace, I guess what you call in your book, you talk about this thing modern distributism, and you draw a distinction between what Chesterton and Belloc were doing, and maybe it's worth you explaining that for us for a moment in just a second here, what Chesterton and Belloc were talking about around the turn of the 20th century and on into the 1930s, and what you say in your book is whenever you have an economic debate or a debate over these issues, the allocation of resources, they talk about property like this and the limits of it and is it good or bad or does it accord with Christian teaching, some of these things. It's, you say in any debate, the distributist usually in terms of economic science is the least educated in terms of having studies and facts, I think, at their command. And this is one of the things in your book, Toward a Truly Free Market, that you're trying to get at. Could you explain the difference here between that? This is my term now, that kind of that sentimental distributism of Chesterton and Belloc that says, look, there was once this thing called Christendom, and when a society is organized, having grown organically in this way over centuries, to and ordered towards man's primary end, which is to know, love, and serve God. Here's what the economy and ownership, et cetera, here's what it looks like. But it doesn't look like the vast wealth of the modern world, but you have a lot of happy people with time for feast days, et cetera. And that's kind of sentimental in the medievalism and growing out of romanticism and some of those things. And what you're trying to do, I think, is take a look at everything from Rerum Novarum up through what Pope Francis talks about in terms of justice and the world's goods, and bring this into the 21st century as a would it be fair to say, as an economic philosophy that you could go head to head and debate people who Catholics who argue that it's prudential to argue for, like the Acton Institute says, a free and virtuous mm-hmm. society, or different understandings of Centesimus Annus, Pope John Paul II's encyclical, which is important to you and important to these other folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's exactly it. I think the early distributists were not as interested in economic research. They just weren't. It just wasn't their thing. And their opponents were the Fabian socialists, who were very interested in economic research. In fact, they did very good research.
And they won, right? I mean, basically.
And they won.
Yeah.
Funny how that works. So, in other words, we have to be... we have to get it down to a practical level. Not only do we have to do that, my contention is you cannot understand supply and demand without understanding justice. That justice, never mind caritas, we can get there later, but justice at least is the primary principle which makes supply and demand work. Because think about it. You have two sides there. You have a transaction. If the demanders get all the benefits, the practical effect is that you will oversupply the capital markets and undersupply the consumer markets. So at first, the capitalist will make a lot of money, but then he has no place to invest it because the markets are underserved. There's not enough demand. So what does he do? Well, the first thing he does is usury. He lends the money back to try to keep up demand levels. All right?
Now, when you say usury, which was outlawed in the Middle Ages and after in Catholic countries in many places, mm-hmm. is there a distinction you draw between that and some kind of legitimate interest?
Yes.
Yes.
Usury. I mean, anybody who supplies capital is entitled to a share of the profits. Absolutely. He supplied something to production. Usury is any interest on a non-productive loan. That is, it's a share in something that isn't produced. Hence, it uses up the stock of society. Hence the name usury. If you're just talking about participating in an investment and you share either the gains or losses of that investment, then there's nothing wrong with that, obviously. But if you're just making money on money without that money producing anything, that's usury. And it's if the lender isn't taking a risk, if he doesn't bear the losses, he shouldn't bear the gains. And if the money has no gains, then he can charge service fees and things like that, but he cannot participate in profits that don't exist. But in any case, demand was held up by consumer lending. Okay, that was one method. The second method was to make the government the consumer of last resort. So government expenditures grow to be the one big consumer in the middle. And that's sort of the history of capitalism always. You always have a growing government to consume the excess that cannot be distributed now through wages. So the point is, justice is a practical consideration. If you don't have an equitable distribution of rewards between suppliers and demanders, supply and demand doesn't work.
You touched on the monetary system there for a bit, and I'd like to point to our listeners here on Faith and Reason to one thing you say in your book, a solution you offer in your book toward a truly free market. You talk about a monetary reform and mm-hmm. how to get to what you also call an ownership society. And all kinds of people use the term ownership society, but you use it in this term as much as possible distributed private property, unless mm-hmm. unless I'm not saying that entirely fair. But you go on to say an example of subsidiarity would be the federal government serving as a bank to states and localities so they could do things with that money. And isn't that also empower – isn't that also going to empower the federal government to – oh, I don't know, he who controls the purse strings, you know, like the capitalist. Doesn't that just put them in the place mm-hmm. of the capitalist? And isn't that even more dangerous since the government is charged with making laws and et cetera?
Yeah. Well, the question here is how money is created. I mean, money is created today through the banks. When the banks make a loan, of course, we're taught to think the banks – take in deposits and lend them out. The banks do not lend out deposits. The banks never lend deposits. The banks create deposits. The money you deposit in a bank is only used as reserves and to meet day-to-day cash needs. But the money they lend out, they create. So the money creation power under fractional reserve banking lies with the banks. And it shouldn't. It's a public power. It shouldn't be privatized. And so the government should create money, and the banks should use that money to lend for productive purposes, matching it with their own funds so that they have an incentive to make good loans, because they will bear losses if they don't, but they cannot create money. So this is called 100% reserve banking. In other words,
okay. Now,
if you lend out money, you actually have to have the money.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Right. Yeah. Now, so other questions I think our listeners here would be interested in. This is the show is Faith and Reason, so we talk about that great dynamic between the two, which is the Catholic way of thinking, and I want to ask this now about distributism. It's just kind of a simple question about whether society and the world as it is now, and this will probably lead to some actual examples of this working now. So we talked about the medieval period and kind of the ideas of Chesterton and Belloc, but is this good for the poor? We're called to have a preferential option for the poor. Is distributism then good for the poor?
It is the preferential option for the poor in operation.
Okay.
Because it seeks to distribute to the poor. It seeks to capitalize the poor and the middle class, so that they can become more self-sufficient, more independent, more truly citizens, than mere wage earners. So yes, it is absolutely oriented toward the poor.
What makes it in your view superior to the arguments posed by, I guess I would call them free market capitalists, or Catholics, excuse me, those who would say those who would like at the Acton Institute, which is based here in Grand Rapids. Because the human person is created free by the virtue of our freedom and natural creativity to let that flourish, we need a free society, a free economy, free exchange, I guess would be their preferred term. What would make distributism superior to that? And I guess I ask because my concern is always going to be who does the distributing at this point in time, and would it necessarily involve coercion, or are we talking about a long-term evolution to a more Christian society, et cetera?
Well, a couple of things there. The first term you used was free market capitalism. Capitalism and the free market are bitter enemies. Those terms should never, ever be confounded.
Hence the title of your book, right?
Seeks to displace the free market. It seeks not free competition, but oligarchy, monopoly, government power. These are all the characteristics of a capitalist system. They use free market terminology as window dressing, but in fact, wherever they can, they displace free and competitive markets. Okay? Walmart is not free market. Walmart is a creation of government.
Right? So should we distinguish between different kinds of capitalism, or are you saying then this is just kind of inevitable? You might say you want free market capitalism, but you're going to end up with what the free marketeers call crony capitalism or managerial
capitalism. Crony capitalism is the only capitalism that has ever existed, that ever could exist. Okay, the free market is just rhetoric for the capitalist, but he hates it. He hates competition. Okay, and so long as he can accumulate enough power, enough capital, he can crush the competition. So, we used to have 100,000 retailers in this country who have all been displaced by Walmart or Staples or the big box stores. Okay, that's not free market. That's capitalism, but it's not free market. they control so much shelf space now that producers are essentially working for Walmart. Walmart is not just a distribution chain. Now it controls production markets. And it's one of the reasons why so much work was outsourced to China. It's because basically Walmart demanded that they do that. Walmart served as practically a branch of the Chinese trade ministry that forces our producers to produce over in China, because if they, Walmart sets the price, Walmart sets the terms. If they can't meet it, then they cannot have shelf space at Walmart. And if they cannot have shelf space at Walmart, they cannot survive.
So how then would you propose we turn that around? Maybe there's some models you'd like to talk about.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, you wanted to talk about, and I think that's a good place to start, you wanted to talk about, well, how does the government figure in this? Understand that the capitalism is not possible without the kind of government we have. Capitalism begins with an act of government violence, the seizure of the monasteries, and it continues that way. So, for example, what you find in places like Walmart is vast government subsidies. The Walmart distribution chain makes absolutely no sense economically. It makes no sense to produce low-value goods in China and ship them to Long Beach, then ship them to Bentonville, then ship them across the country. So the shipping costs alone should wipe out any labor advantage. Well, how does Walmart survive then? It doesn't pay the shipping costs, because we have what's called the freeway system. And the freeway system, the shippers are effectively subsidized. Now, if there were weight and distance tolls on the highways, so if they had to actually pay the full costs of their freight, this distribution system of Walmart would make no sense. You wouldn't be shipping socks from China. You'd want to get your socks made locally, so you wouldn't have to ship them 10,000 miles. So this freeway system is inherently a subsidy to those who can take the most advantage of it by shipping the most goods the longest distance. That gives you the biggest subsidy. And so if you had weight and distance tolls, the Walmart system would collapse immediately.
So
how it works?
Yeah, so legislation, obviously then legislation regulation is necessary in the name of, in the name of the getting to an actually free market.
That's correct.
And so
there's no market without rules. You need rules to have a market.
So you say Keynesianism is summarized as a managed economy, and I guess one of the most important things that distributists argue, and you do so in your book, is that while the rest of us are out here looking at socialism and capitalism as these opposite things, or as taking Hayek and opposing him to Keynes, that these are all actually kind of one and the same thing. And which doesn't make distributism a third way at all. But it makes it a way of getting it, as you say it, in your book, a truly free market.
You might say that distributism is not the third way. It's the second way. Capitalism/socialism are the first way. They're not all that different from each other. And in practice, they look almost exactly the same.
And so the question is always who's controlling the property? Is that... where the similarity lies?
In both systems, the idea of property is lost. So a modern corporation really isn't property, okay? Any more than if the state owns that, it really isn't property. It is not property that's proper to a man. Rather, a whole bunch of anonymous stockholders who are unknown to each other for the most part own little bits of paper that give them certain rights over the profit stream from that company and certain rights to elect its directors. Okay, but it's not. That's a very attenuated. That's a very weak form of property. I mean, owning a share of IBM doesn't give me the right to enter any IBM facility and say, "Let me in. I'm the owner." But if I owned IBM, then I could enter any IBM property and say, "I'm the owner. You can't keep me out." So it's a government created form of ownership. It's not a natural form of ownership. It's a very recent origin. So the limited liability stock corporation, which, by the way, Adam Smith opposed precisely for these reasons, is we call that ownership, and it's ownership of a sort, but you have to look at it for what it is. It's a government-created form of ownership that doesn't naturally exist. It took a long time to develop. Since it's a social creation, you can put social limitations on it. I mean, there's nothing contrary to nature or contrary to property or anything else by looking at it for what it is and then seeing what kind of restrictions you can or should or prudentially should put on such forms of property.
Let's, if we can, in the last 15 minutes of our show here, turn to papal teaching, which I know a lot of our listeners are going to be interested in. And when it comes to papal encyclicals, whether we're talking about Rerum Novarum, which really inspired a lot of distributists and people who called themselves, I think, corporatists during the late 19th, early 20th century, but also the writings of Pope John Paul and, of course, the statements and writings. There's not all that much yet of Pope Francis. If you could, can you connect those things you've been saying to these very important papal documents, which others would read, others have read differently, right, to argue for a different kind of economic arrangement. But let's take a look at that. Maybe, starting with Leo XIII in Rerum Novarum, which most people would hold as this is the launch of a greater emphasis in the church on what's now called what people tend to call social justice and Catholic social teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's kind of a large topic.
It is.
Social justice actually comes in. Well, actually, the term arises in Italy in 1840 with Luigi Taparelli. But it doesn't really come into its own until Quadragesimo Anno.
Well, maybe let's start with Pius XI then. Yeah, let's start. We could do that too, and maybe we could corral this a bit then and talk about it in terms of subsidiarity. Which you do quite a bit with in your book, and which those who advocate what they call a free market say, hey, this is what subsidiarity is, and you're saying, no, this is what subsidiarity is. And let's talk about it in that context then, because subsidiarity is easy for folks also to look up in the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Subsidiarity is rooted in social justice, and here's what you have to understand about it. The Leo XIII, when he speaks about the just wage, tends to make it an individual question, a question for each individual businessman. You should pay a just wage. But the truth of the matter is, the individual businessman is not free in many cases to pay a given wage. So if he's trying to compete against goods made in markets that are virtual slave labor, okay, there's he's under a market constraint that he cannot overcome by his own efforts. And it is not proper to hold a person accountable for something they can't control. And that was the point of Pius XI in introducing the term social justice, that where it was impossible to pay just wages, then you needed social reform. You needed reform of systems. So it is not just individuals, because individuals always exist in a social context. There's no isolated individual that we can locate anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We all have a last name. We all have a history. We all have a community. We all have language. So we have these social elements. And so social justice then emphasizes this social nature of man, and that in talking about reform, we need to talk about reform of individuals, but reform of systems as well, reform of social and economic systems. That's social justice. Okay, so how does that relate to subsidiarity? Well, subsidiarity is the principle of hierarchy, and it does a very strange thing. It stands hierarchy on its head. Normally, when we think of hierarchies, we think of the lower units serving the higher units. What subsidiarity does is reverse that. It says, no, no, no. The only reason to have a hierarchy is because local units, the family, so let's say, cannot do everything. They are dependent for some functions on higher units, on higher levels of organization. So a hierarchy is only justified by the help, or in Latin, subsidium, it can give to the lower levels. That's what subsidiarity is. So the highest must serve the lowest. And when you put it like that, then you've also united the second term, solidarity. When the highest serves the lowest, then this preferential option for the poor makes perfect sense. You see? So subsidiarity and solidarity are really two halves of the same thing. So subsidiarity is that hierarchical, that vertical dimension of society. Solidarity is that horizontal level, level where everybody's on the same level. Subsidiarity is where they're all on different levels. So that's the both the distinction and the unity of those terms.
When St. John Paul talks about subsidiarity in Gentesimus Annus, he talks about it as the opposite of not simply a society of corporate capitalism and that kind of thing, but what he calls this social assistance state. That is this overwhelming bureaucratic state that's doing all kinds of things for us. And that, it's not really filling our needs in the way we could be filling our neighbor's needs. So in other words, the way I read this and see what you think is, it would be, at some point I'm going to stop loving my neighbor if the government's doing those sorts of things that would be entailed in what it means to love my neighbor, and human nature being what it is, I'm just going to start doing other stuff because I know my neighbor's taken care of. So subsidiarity has just been harmed and farmed out to the government, but it's not really – I really don't need the higher order to come in and help me, but it's doing it anyway. I mean, does that make sense to you? In other words
– Well, not really. The John Paul talks about the individual being crushed between the market and the state, okay, because both of those have grown to such immense proportions. People who use the term subsidiarity in that way usually mean it in the sense of, say, privatizing charity. That's not what it is at all. It is localizing charity, but not privatizing it. They hark back to a time when the church did indeed have these functions, and the church was displaced by the state. So in the Middle Ages, the church had enormous governmental authorities. It had authority over what we would now call welfare, over education, over marriage. it was itself a vast economic engine. Okay, it had its own law courts, which even had jurisdiction over certain civil cases, for instance, infanticide. However, what we forget about that, what we constantly forget, is that the church accomplished those duties, those purely governmental duties, not through charitable contributions, but through taxation. That is, the church collected the land taxes, which were the foundation of medieval taxation, but did not remit them to the king. She kept them to perform her own governmental functions.
Which the kings were not very happy about.
The kings, after 1,000 years, were able to displace the church from that function. But the church had another tax. The church had an income tax, the mandatory tithe, which was both an income tax and a wealth tax. And so the church discharged all of these functions primarily through its tax revenues. I've never seen a proper accounting of it, but I believe that the tax revenues of the church, I'm counting the charitable contributions, but the tax revenues of the church were probably higher than the tax revenues of the prince. They certainly could not have been much less. So, in other words, the church recognized always a social obligation in fulfilling these duties. Now, it was subsidiarity because it was discharged at a local level, discharged by people who were neighbors to each other. Okay, so that's the difference. It was not, however, this model of privatized charity that we have today. That just never happened and could not happen, not unless people become a whole lot more generous. I know I work with St. Vincent de Paul Society, and we could not possibly accomplish our work without things like food stamps.
Okay, so
we couldn't raise anywhere near enough money to meet the problems.
So, the way to meet the ultimate problem of poverty, though, is not simply more food stamps or that type of aid or charity, but caritas, right? I mean, love and how do we?
Well, no, but I find that a little bit too abstract. The way to properly meet it is the distribution of property. Okay.
And so we want to find the best way to do that.
Yeah. If you have more people who are self-reliant, they will, one, okay, not be on welfare, and two, be able to be better able to have a surplus left over to take care of their neighbors who do indeed need some welfare. So, and so a lot of the problem will happen to begin with.
They're going to have to. So in that kind of system, then we're talking about still coming down to this. Need or inspiration to love one's neighbor.
Yes, yes. But again, love one's neighbor in practical terms. So we can't divorce justice and economics. We can't divorce the ethical world from the practical world. So property is not only part of economics, it's part of justice. So you got to bridge those gaps. We have to stop thinking in separate categories and bridge the categories, join them together.
Now, John Madai, we've been talking for the last 50 minutes or so. Kind of a wide-ranging discussion, really, and I think if somebody tuned in partway, they think they've tuned into an economics program. In a way they have today. In our closing moments here, I'd like to ask you, as I think I would call you certainly one of the leaders in this movement for distributism, to give us your your opinion on Pope Francis, who among some Americans, even American Catholics, they're uneasy with some of the things he says economically, and those who like what he says in terms of economics and justice and distributive justice would say, well, you know, you used to be really comfortable, you said, with some of the things Pope Benedict or John Paul said, but you're doing mental calisthenics to get around these things Pope Francis says, but we have to take it all in as Catholics and seek to understand it. So I guess with that, I'll kind of leave it to you to assess Pope Francis.
I think
you
just said it, because the truth about Francis is that he has said nothing that is different from what Benedict or John Paul said. Nothing. He has, however, said it in a way that cannot be spun. And I think that's his rhetorical goal. John Paul's Centesimus Annus was read by some in an ideological manner as a support for capitalism. That it was done so, to me, is just absolutely astounding, since he's very carefully states that it is not that at all. Pope Francis is determined not to let himself be spun out of existence. And he is very, very in your face. But the things he is saying are not different from what Benedict and John Paul said, or what Pius XI or XII or Leo XIII said. It's all on the same continuum. It's all the same thing. It's just that he's going to state it in no uncertain terms, whereas Benedict would state it in very, very scholarly terms.
Okay. That's interesting, and I think most Catholics would, a while back, I think Pope Francis said something about, I think it was, the topic may have been the rights of the unborn or abortion. And some people were very surprised, particularly BBC journalists and others, who thought this was their pope in that sense, because he agreed with them on some things. And they think, that this is how it works in the Catholic Church, that each pope gets to come in and just kind of do his own thing. And because he's pope, we're all supposed to believe it. And I just remember thinking, well, surprise, the pope's Catholic. Who knew?
Oh, yeah,
he hadn't talked about this stuff before.
Who
and,
knew?
You know, there
Who
he
knew?
Is. Yeah, there he is being Catholic again. Maybe we don't like him after all. And so it's interesting to hear you say this. So maybe not even a matter of nuance, you would argue, between Centesimus Annus and what Pope Francis is saying, but there's just there's a misreading of Centesimus Annus would be the distributist argument. And what
I think there's a deliberate misreading of Centesimus Annus and Laborum Exertions as well. And Caritas in Veritate mostly just ignored but St. Thomas, Pope Francis, you cannot possibly ignore what he's saying, and it's very difficult to spin.
Well, I do want to thank you for coming on the program today, John Madai. It's been interesting to talk with you, and I hope at least our listeners have gotten the distributist argument inside of things from you. We've wanted to have you on Faith and Reason for quite a while, and as I try to do with every show, I teach at a college called Aquinas College. And so I try to bring out the best in everybody. That's my job as a host. So we don't, I hope that people got a good sense for your book, Towards a Truly Free Market, and a good sense of distributism. And I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And dear listener, thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason, and thank you for listening to Holy Family Radio. This is Dr. John Pinero. Good afternoon.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is professor of history and director of Catholic studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.